Umar, thank you so much for joining in. I am very excited about this conversation. It's something that I've been wanting to do for the last 3 weeks, ever since I came across you on YouTube. I have been reading about you, and I've also been developing a really keen interest in neuroscience and neuromarketing. So, yeah, thank you, and welcome to the Sid Warrior podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I am super excited to be here.
So, just at the onset, do you mind just introducing yourself to the audience as to where you're from and what do you do?
Absolutely. So, I am currently an assistant professor with a dual appointment between two of the schools at the University of California, San Diego. So, I'm part of the School for Global Policy and Strategy. And I'm also part of the Rady School of Management, so both business and policy. Now, my formal role there is effectively as a marketing professor, but the broader scope of my role and of my research is that I am a neuroeconomist. So I have a background in both marketing and in neuroscience. In fact, I have a PhD in both of those disciplines. So I started out as a neuroscientist and then shifted my career over towards studying the brain in the context of how people make real-world decisions about buying things in grocery stores and choosing a job and figuring out financial investments. And so it wasn't so much that I flipped my career, it was more that I expanded it into a new place. And started studying using these tools from neuroscience to also study decision making in real world settings.
Wonderful. This switch between neuromarketing, between neuroscience and marketing, would you say that it is a recent phenomenon? The understanding that neuroscience can influence marketing.
Yeah, so yes and no. I think its adoption has gotten a lot more attention and popular press in the last 10, maybe even 15 years. But interestingly enough, some of the initial forays into the space were done 20, almost 30 years ago now. So, for example, at Harvard University, a professor named Gerald Zaltman, Jerry Zaltman at HBS, business school, was a colleague of a fairly well-known cognitive psychologist named Stephen Kosslyn, and they talked quite a bit. And Jerry felt strongly that there was a lot about our emotions and our unconscious processing that was important to making decisions, but wasn't possible to measure with the more traditional survey tools or focus groups that marketing tended to use to do its research. And so he was, Jerry at the time was very interested in using positron emission tomography, so PET scan, brain scans, to try and get some sense of what was going on under that conscious level. The brain scanning technique that I use is called magnetic resonance imaging. In fact, because I look at how patterns of how people are thinking, it's actually fMRI or functional magnetic resonance imaging. And fMRI really wasn't a big deal at the time that Jerry and Steve Coslin were looking at these ideas. And so they were using whatever techniques were seemed more tractable at the time. Now, it didn't pick up in a big way in industry, and these are huge, complex research machines. And Zaltman and Coslin were both faculty at one of the most prestigious universities in the world, so they were the kind of people who could push those envelopes. I think that as the technology, like my scanning technique, like fMRI, advanced, it opened up more possibilities. But also, as the research science advanced, we got to a place where the kind of information we could get from brain scans was sufficiently relevant and interpretable to how people work in the real world that it became more possible to study these questions. So the kind of data you could get in the 1980s from brain scanning techniques may or may not have actually been like broad or sufficient or good enough in some ways to get answers that were usable and applicable in real companies in real time.
Right.
But as we moved into the 90s, we started getting more and more information about how the brain worked as well as these methods. And then we move into the 2000s, and now people are using these methods to ask more complicated questions about decisions.
Mm.
And if you can ask complicated questions about decisions between a square and a circle, you can start asking complicated questions about decisions between apples and oranges or computers.
Apples and windows.
Apples and windows, exactly. And so so we basically took a while for all of those pieces to fall into place, not only in the corporate world, but really honestly on the science side as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the conflicts that I assume will come out of this discussion is that from the beginning of this whole story, one thing has remained constant, which is that businesses or industries wouldn't really care how you do it as long as you get it done. They would want insights that would ultimately lead to their profit margin increasing. So do you think that there is a sense of urgency in proving that these methods work, even if it is premature?
That's a fascinating question. I think that if a business was a consultancy where they were talking to other businesses, for example, so if I was out there talking to businesses trying to sell them my neuromarketing techniques, I could imagine that I might want to accelerate the abilities that I might be able to have. I think in terms of the business's standpoint, if I'm Coca-Cola or Nike, I have so many opportunities now, because while the brain data has been getting better, the analytics have been getting better too, and the computer data has also been getting better, that I don't need to rush the brain data through the system unless I'm confident I can get something out of it. So I think from the perspective of the clients, or from the perspective of the consumer packaged goods firms like Coca-Cola, from the perspective of the retailers, rushing it isn't as critical. With that said, new is fun, right? So new technologies are exciting, even if they're in what Silicon Valley might call its beta phase. And so we love new forms of data. We love getting an edge in industry. And that is almost a third silent player, whether you're, you know, the big firms or the consultancies or the scientists trying to find those, you know, new results. I don't think that things have been rushed in. I do think that there's a really interesting question that you bring up about which part of the science is the most relevant for a company, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to a company if the science is perfect, as long as it's good enough to fix the bottom line. And so that's a really interesting tension, because the companies don't need to actually figure out how the brain works. The companies just need to get information from this measure that's good enough to tell them how to change how their company works, or how to promote some kind of product, or how to communicate with their customers. And so even if the understanding of the brain is still developing, it may be that as long as the technique gives more information about what the company should do, they are not as concerned about whether it's a perfect description of exactly what the true brain function is.
Yeah. You know what this reminds me of? The saying that war is the mother of invention. And let's be fair, the war that we're living in right now is a corporate war. And the one way to think about this would be that a general of an army in a country wouldn't really care about the science behind a new gun or a new rocket, as long as it hits the target, as long as it creates an appreciable difference in the outcome of the war. But because of that sense of urgency, the scientists might work at creating better and better rockets.
Ah, interesting. So I have to say, it's already an uncertain enough world that it's a little difficult to think about it in the context of a combat metaphor, although I think the metaphor fits. It's just
a little uncomfortable
for war for a minute. There's an interesting point here about whether the scientists feel that urgency as well. And the reality is, again, in terms of how the science side is developing, I think it's worth exploring what the academic science of neuroscience and marketing actually looks like. So there's a distinction between marketing as it occurs in the corporate world and marketing as a field of study in a university, which is where some of the science comes from. Not all of it. The corporate world's making amazing advances as well. But in terms of where these scientists are coming from, some of us are professors at university. And so I think for us, like the scientists in the psychology department, like the scientists in the neuroscience department, the sense of urgency is because we have little time and so many questions. You know, I only have so many years in which I'm going to be able to investigate all of these questions, and they're fascinating and they're important. Right. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things as a scientist, to study something that is important and could change the way that we think about how we think and how we go about making decisions is enough of a motivation to try and push the limit of these technologies as far as they would go. And our mandate as scientists is often to make those advances.
Right.
So I think that the motivation on the science side is not necessarily to help the company per se. There are certainly companies that help companies. There are companies out there developing these technologies. There's a company named Kernel that's developing yet another brain scanning technology and taking it forward. It's called magnetic encephalography and MEG. And they have a version of MEG that uses a much more tractable system. It's more portable. It's got a lot more potential benefits to be applied in the medical or potentially corporate space. But again, I think the driver for that was changing the technology, and then the application dovetailed with it. So in terms of who's building the better guns, I feel like guns and brains are not a good fit.
I can see you already having second thoughts about this whole discussion.
I think that the motivation is not just hitting the target for the generals. I think the motivation is the elegance of the machinery itself and what it tells us more broadly, and the development of the technology as in service of science, in service of the broad questions of humanity and consciousness and decision making.
I love that. I love that the main driver is cognitive curiosity.
Both in terms of what drives it and in terms of what we're studying in some way.
Yeah, there's a nice little metaphor in there. When we spoke last, we talked about the difference between academic and marketing neuroscience. I had recently come across this differentiation in the terms of consumer neuroscience versus academic neuromarketing. And I'm a little confused as to how do you differentiate these terms? Are they abstract, or do they have a relevant difference in the academic circles?
Yeah, this is all marketing. So the initial term that was used for the application of methods from neuroscience to marketing was neuromarketing. That was the term that was coined, I believe, by Alice Smits, who's currently a marketing professor at Erasmus University. And I think he was one of the first people to, if not use the term, certainly make it more popular, bring it into the public sphere. And again, this was, I'm very bad at estimating the years, but it was more than 10 years ago, some time ago. The challenge is that neuromarketing as a term in industry was co-opted by some companies that weren't doing great science. Some of them were promising things that just weren't possible. Some of them were explaining their findings in terms of science that just couldn't happen or wasn't necessarily quite right. And I think that presented a challenge, an ethical challenge for neuroscientists, because on the one hand, as long as the company is doing their thing, hopefully no one's getting hurt. On the other hand, there's what looks like scientific information going out to the public that's incorrect. And mostly you could say, well, it's just happening behind the scenes, but it wasn't just happening behind the scenes. It was people publishing books and articles and saying, we understand the brain and we found the buy button. And so this is a challenge, right? This is a problem because on the one hand, we would love to use neuroscience techniques to study consumer psychology. And on the other hand, if all of this stuff is flooding the public awareness in New York Times articles and things like that, the scientists are now fighting the field in a way that's really awkward. And we don't want it to look like we in the science or academic world endorse some of this maybe not so accurate stuff that's being used in the corporate world.
Right.
So this caused a little bit of stress. And we're marketing professors. We should know how to brand things. Right? So what happened is that while there are plenty of people who still use the term neuromarketing in academia and in the corporate world, mm-hmm. I think there was a little bit of a pause when some of those initial things were a little too shaky. Some of those initial, you know, communications out of the corporate world maybe could have been a little more solid. Mm. Not all of them. A lot of people were doing great work, but some of them weren't great. And it made the term neuromarketing a bad brand. Right? Neuromarketing is this snake oil stuff, and they say they can put a helmet on your brain and understand your thoughts. And, you know, they plenty of real scientists have debunked what these cheesy companies are doing to try and sell you things. So the term consumer neuroscience was sort of more of a academically generated term for the science publications. There's no distinction between the two realistically. I mean, you can draw those distinctions. There are plenty of people who feel that there should be differences between these two things. Oh, neuromarketing is in the market and consumer neuroscience is what the scientists do. Realistically, they're both brands. And
right.
One arose mostly as a reaction to the other, but I don't know what the current name of the division is, but the Nielsen company, the huge data gathering company, international data gathering company, has a division that was titled Nielsen Consumer Neuroscience. So it's very clear the companies can use that word too.
Of course, because it's not a copyrighted.
Not at all. And there are plenty of academics who would say, I do neuromarketing. You know, I mean, if someone says, do you do neuromarketing? I'm not exactly going to say no, because it's not exactly the title that I would pick for what I do. But I get it, what they're trying to communicate.
It's not your preferred academic pronoun, but then it's until people.
Exactly. But it's not wrong.
It's not wrong. Yeah. When we spoke last, we had talked about a very interesting concept of how you put a paper and you put a graph next to it versus you'd put an image of an fMRI brain next to it. And people are more likely to believe the paper which has the fMRI picture. This is because of our preconceived notions. This is because of our subconscious drives that make you think that anything to do with the brain is more trustworthy. I feel we're discussing about the same thing when we talk of neuromarketing. People would push some traditional marketing concept and just attach the word neuro in front of it, and people would buy it more. What do you think?
Absolutely. And this absolutely happens. So my favorite example, which I may have also mentioned to you, is dopamine fasting. So one of the terms that's come from neuroscience into the world of marketing is dopamine. And you see this description everywhere. They got a hit of dopamine from liking this social media post. Oh, we're just all waiting for our next hit of dopamine. Dopamine is the pleasure chemical. It's the buy button again, right? The it rules everything about how we do make all of our decisions. Now, dopamine is a critical chemical in the context of reward and decision-making. So it's not shocking to neuroscientists that it's a relevant idea, not just idea, but actual practical part of the circuits involved. And I realize I'm talking to a neurologist, so you should probably be telling me what dopamine does.
Oh, no.
But we are now at a point where it's so casually used in conversation that sort of casual reference has taken on extra meaning because it sounds sciencey, not scientific, sciencey.
There's a difference.
And so sciencey sounding stuff is very convincing. And we kind of know this. I mean, we've been having complex conversations on an international scale about the science of COVID for the last 2 years. And people look for scientific facts to back up their arguments, even if the argument that they're making is more social. So if we go back to dopamine fasting or dopamine, one of the examples is that there is a company out there that promotes dopamine fasting. And it's basically a behavioral intervention to help people meditate a little bit more, to take a step back. I mean, particularly for Indians, right? Some of the ideas about clearing your mind or meditation or withdrawing from the intensity of the daily world to a place where you can find a moment of inner peace is a pretty well-known and long-standing practice, almost, including at a religious as well as at a practical scale. And so it's been branded as dopamine fasting to help it sound more sciencey and to make it more attractive. Now, again, as a neurologist, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is if I actually sucked all the dopamine out of your brain, it's not just that you would make decisions differently, but I would probably give you a motor disease like Parkinson's. Because my understanding is that as a neuroscientist, dopamine does a lot of things, and it's not just about pleasure or whether you're liking posts on social media or how good chocolate cake tastes. It's also about coordinating your movements and managing a lot of systems in a lot of the brain. So dopamine fasting is unlikely to be a thing. In fact, I think we would actually be quite worried if these techniques were really changing the balance of this critical neurotransmitter. But it sounds sciencey.
It
And
sounds sciencey and
it's not unlikely to be hurting anyone. And so, oh, I went for a dopamine fast sounds so much cooler than, I went
I
and
switched
had
off my phone for a day.
exactly. So yes, we're at a place where even if there's no neuromarketing or consumer neuroscience taking place, the language has adopted some of this, or putting the brain scan picture makes it look more sciencey and therefore more compelling, because the implication is that there's science and an argument behind it in a way that is is seemingly more advanced than just psychology or just what an average person could test.
Right,
So
and
the
that has
Oh, please go ahead.
no, continue.
Oh, the implication of the argument is, it's not just me making this argument, it's that there's science and real scientists and people who have studied this, and the experts say, it's very much about the expert opinion. And, if you could do these brain scans, you could find out this too. But since we know it, this is based on the best scientific techniques.
Right.
And so, it gets overused in a sense. The neuromarketing here is not the scanning of anybody's brain or the technique being used. It's putting neuroscience words as marketing copy and
Exactly.
advertisement.
It's a way of convincing people that, hey, you can relax. We have figured stuff out so that you don't have to. And it's a lazy technique of comforting people. People who
It's
are
prescriptive for sure.
People who are in that middle zone of wanting to be evidence-based, but they don't want to put in the time to read the evidence. Neuroscience is great for that, if you just put in that word.
It looks important. It looks like there's more truth to it. There's a funny half of this that's not corporate, that's just that you can see happening. Some of my colleagues have referred to it as the scanner truth serum. When people make decisions in the regular world, like just making decisions in their everyday lives, they will often make what looks like irrational decisions. It might be based on impulse, it might be based on bias, it might just be because they're tired. People make a range of decisions that don't always look perfectly consistent. When people are in an fMRI scanner, they will often make very consistent, very rational decisions. Now, people are complex. There's no reason they couldn't make the rational decisions outside of the scanner too, but there's this sort of feeling in some of our participants that join us in our studies that we can see the truth in their brains if when we're doing these brain scans, and therefore they should make sure not to lie. And
Lie.
it's not even a lie. It's just they should make sure to be as accurate as possible, because if they get it wrong, their brains will reveal some other kind of truth. Now, of course, we don't have that kind of interpretation of the kind of brain data that we get. We get very complex brain data that represents some features of brain activity, but is not a mind reader in any way, shape, or form. But just the presence of the machinery is enough to trigger that, you know, these people have authority, these people are doing real science, and so I better shape up and make sure that this is as good as possible. When what we really want to study is, how do you make decisions when you're tired? How do you make decisions in the real world? It's fine if you want to pick chocolate cake over fruit salad. We do not judge you for that. Heck, I'd be the first person to pick up the chocolate cake instead of the fruit salad, which is the responsible choice. Yeah. But it's hard to do that when you have the brain scanner apparently reading your thoughts.
Right. The brain scanner is now...
Clear. Cannot read thoughts.
Yeah, let's be very clear on that. But I kind of get why people would think that, because the brain scanner has taken the place of the religious leader in your cult. So that, you know, when you are in front of that man or that woman, and it's somebody that you respect, and it's somebody that you think has magical powers, you're not likely to lie. You're more likely to go in a state of submission, that whatever you say, I will do. And it's the essence of it is the same. It's something that you don't understand, and you believe that those people know more than you do. So I can understand why somebody with no scientific background or no neuroscience background would fall for that, because the aura is that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very old principle in psychology called the appeal to authority. And it's actually a persuasive principle. If I want to convince you of something, you know, it's like putting the brain picture is more convincing than a bar graph.
Right.
I could wear a sweater, which is what I'm wearing now, or I could wear a sweater and put a lab coat on it.
Yeah.
And then I would be a scientist, because the lab coat is communicating authority, even if I say nothing different to you.
Okay.
So with my lab coat on, I'm a scientist. And in fact, people behave differently if they see people with lab coats on. People behave differently if your boss, I mean, we know, you, of course you behave differently when your boss is there, or your mother, or your religious person. And so this idea of authority, of a someone who understands how you should be, regardless of whether or not that currently matches up with the way you're feeling and what you would be doing normally, that can absolutely change people's behavior.
This is very useful.
And so, calling a dopamine can change your behavior. Putting people in an fMRI scanner can make them think that they should be more careful. As you gain familiarity with these situations, that effect diminishes. More people know that we can't actually read their minds, so it's not as much of an issue. So a lot of the questions, for example, a lot of the questions that I give people in my experiments aren't necessarily even that difficult. It's like, would you like this mug? Versus, would you like these colored pencils? There's no moral benefit of choosing one or the other. I really just want to know which one you like better. That's all I'm asking. So that those kinds of questions can also put people at ease, or obvious ones, right? Like, would you like to take this gamble? The reason for you to do it is obviously dependent on how worth it you think the risk is. So that can remove some of those biases on the science side.
Do you feel the weight of psychology behind everything that neuroscience does?
Oh, what a great question, and what a complicated one. I feel like I should be asking you the same thing.
You can, but I want to hear yours first.
I should start by saying that my entire career, and I won't even call it my career, my entire educational experience, even before it was a career, has been driven by the idea that interdisciplinary approaches are going to tell us a lot more about how people think and how the brain works, and that's not something that we should be dividing into silos, but something that you could almost think of as a seamless experience. And so you have genetics, and genetics builds, you know, proteins, and proteins build tissue, and there are cells and tissues, and that's going to build brain circuits, and those circuits are going to determine behavior at some level. All of, you know, I skipped psychology. The circuits are going to determine psychology. Psychology is going to drive behavior. It's all really a continuous thing. And so if you study behavior, you could be studying brain things at the same time. So from my perspective, it's not that one drives the other. And sometimes the neuroscience, I feel, could drive the psychology. It is, however, true that we've had more tools for psychology to let us ask those psychological questions for longer than we've had the tools that let us ask humans or connect humans' brains to those questions as well.
Right.
So rats, we've been studying rats for a really long time, other animals, fish brains, really tons and tons of other systems to get these glimpses. But we haven't necessarily had, there's been a gap in the tools that we've been able to use to connect some of those basic understanding of biology with the psychology bit. So they've been, the two ends of the spectrum for humans have been developing really rapidly, and we kind of didn't have enough brain science to connect them in the middle up to this point. And
is
so
that changing now?
Sorry, say that again, please.
Is that changing now?
I think it is. I mean, again, honestly, the tools that we have to make those connections are not necessarily the ones that I would design in my head if I wanted to bridge that gap. I mean, we do not want to mess with people's brains, right? Measurement tools should not be what we refer to medically as invasive. Right? You can put a cap on someone's head. You can use a scanning technique that can measure information without actually opening up anything. But these things are imperfect. The distance to measure what's going on in my brain has to pass through all this hair and scalp and skull. And all of that stuff is really important to me. I like my hair, but really difficult to measure signal through, right? So if I'm trying to measure brain waves, to use a colloquial term, it's going to be filtered through all of these layers of things. So it's a bit like listening on the other side of a door that's insulated. They're still really good techniques. They can still give us a lot of information, but when we use techniques like functional magnetic resonance imaging, like an older technique called electroencephalography or EEG, we are getting proxies. We're getting close to a kind of brain signal, but it's not as if we're getting the information from all the cells doing all their electrical activity in the brain.
Right.
So it's blurred. It's a blurry picture. It's a blurry sound through a door. And that means that we do the best that we can using math and computational models and psychology and biology to come at these questions from all angles and fill in as many of the gaps as we can. And as the technology gets better, maybe we'll get more information. And maybe one day we'll crack some code in physics to help us figure out how to know what each neuron is saying to each other to build perfect models of the brain. To be fair, we haven't figured out artificial intelligence either. So I feel like brain science is doing okay.
Is okay. One of the challenges that I anticipate happening is the more we understand neuroscience and the more we connect it to psychology, things that make sense from a psychology perspective, like say a personality test, but however accurate or inaccurate it might be, or an approximation it might be of a person, it is a fairly popular idea to the extent that I know companies that use personality tests to decide if they should hire somebody, whether who would be a good fit in which team. They have these metrics, right? Now, let's take a hypothetical that one day we advance in neuroscience enough to have a neuroscience version of a personality test.
Yeah.
What ethical doors would that open? Because would we be hiring people based on their brain scans? Is that something that you think is even possible?
This is an amazing question, in part because I'm aware of at least one company that has designed hiring resource tests based off of neuroscience. So they're out there already in some shape or form. So as hypothetical as this question is, there are people who are using a version of it in the market now.
Right.
Now, they're not using brain scans to hire. What's happening is they're taking all the science from brain scans and seeing which personality tests mimic the information that we get from brain scans the best, and then using those personality tests to do this kind of hiring decisions. And so they will bring you a solution set for your company that would mimic the information they say you could get from a neuroscience scan. I'm probably oversimplifying their process, but it is a thing that's out there in the market.
Yeah, and that itself is mind-blowing.
You know, This is one of the really complex ethical problems. So I think that there are a lot of ethical questions that arise once you start using, once you get any broader picture of what people are doing. I think there are really important ethical questions about data privacy. If you can track every single behavior that I do during a day, you know, if you can film me shopping, you have a very rich data set about who I am, and you can predict a lot of things about what I might do in the future. You can probably copy my motions. You could probably replicate my voice. You could probably guess what I might do next in a number of different situations from an hour of me grocery shopping. So the question, the ethical question then becomes, how much worse is this or more invasive is this if you add brain data? And then you get this weird thing. Remember what I said about the brain data being filtered through all these layers? Like, at what point is the brain data better than the behavioral data? Because I think we're assuming that it's better, and it's certainly a different kind of data. So it gives a more 360 view of the person. It's new information. So presumably we can build in new models. And it certainly feels invasive because it feels like it's something so private that even we don't have access to it as we're going about our day.
Yeah.
The reality of the data you actually get from a lot of brain scans is that it's probably not as informative as filming someone for an hour, unless it's on a very, because it's a very specific task that they're doing when you get the brain data, right? Like you have to have them focus on a particular kind of decision, a particular kind of space, and they're not encountering the world in all of its complexity. So you're getting a precise and stereotyped version of the whole pattern of brain activity while they're doing something. But you're not getting as many different interactions with the complexity of the world. And what if a gust of air blows through? And what if someone says something rude to you? Or, you know, all of those random things, we control for that. We take that out when we're doing brain scans to make sure that we can be precise about what we're learning.
Right. But in the real world, we can't do that.
Yeah, exactly. So in the current stage, the ethical question gets easier to answer or to be dismissive about because it's just, well, you know, it's not clear that the brain data is really accessing all that much more than all the other forms of data that people are also collecting.
Right.
A little bit cheap, that answer. It's a little bit of a runaway answer because that's in the current form. And you could imagine that maybe in the next version,
once Neuralink gets into the business world,
yeah, you could get into people's thoughts, you know. So it's easy to answer the right now question. It becomes a lot harder when you think about the abstract version of that question. Like, yeah, and now you're saying we're okay, but how about 5 years, 10 years, I don't know, 2 years if there's a breakthrough.
Yeah.
And then it just becomes really hard. And then I think my personal opinion, I should say, I don't want to speak for the field here. My personal opinion is we should be grappling with these questions now because we have the luxury of doing so while it's still more on the hypothetical side, but also that these questions are not distinct from the ones we should be asking about general forms of data privacy and autonomous privacy and consent. You know, who gets to say what you get to measure and what you don't get to measure. Again, the current setup of brain science is that I cannot sneak up on you with a brain recording device. They're huge. They're giant magnets that fill up an entire room. Even the fast, flexible ones are complex sets of wires that are attached to a cap. Like, I can't creep up on you and throw one at you and magically measure some brain things. So right now, consent, again, not that much of a problem. But you know what I can do is, I can take someone's computer camera and turn it on, possibly with them not even noticing, and figure out where they're looking at the screen. And that form of eye tracking can be very subtle.
Right.
I can have a camera in a store and detect where, you know, how the muscles in someone's face is moving and see whether they look happy or sad when they look at my new product.
Right.
So it's not that theoretical.
I would argue that, though. It's
a bigger conversation.
Right, like that information might be even more useful currently. The problem with neural data is that things might get lost in translation twice while going in and coming out. So if we can directly get eye tracking and facial expressions, though, that is something that we can directly understand and use.
Yeah, That's a great point. There's very little translation needed. If I'm looking at your product on the screen, I am looking at your product on the screen. That's all you need to know. You don't need to think about what the signal means and whether it represents these cells or those cells and which part of the brain it comes from. You just know I'm looking at the screen. So it's a methodology. Again, the term is eye tracking. It's counted under neuromarketing techniques. It's actually been around for, as a technique or as a measurement ability, it's been around for a really long time. And it's in many ways like behavior. It's like knowing what's on everybody's receipt, right? When we use our store loyalty cards, the stores get data on what we bought this time and compare it to the data on what we bought all the previous times. We sign up for it. We tell them they can do that, right? Well, I definitely want those deals. I want to be able to get a six pack of toilet paper for 50% off. So I will let you look at all of the things I've bought by logging all those purchases on this card. At what
Why not?
stage might we end up getting enough benefits that we offer permission for you to see where I'm looking at the screen or for you to track what kind of emotions I'm responding to your ad with or brain scans. I mean, certainly at this stage, again, people are voluntarily offering this information. I think the complex ethical question comes up with at what point is it possible to detect this information silently or without any negative outcomes to the person, at which case who gets to consent? And again, we have some really interesting problems where these bits of these questions have appeared with other technologies. Should people who are testing self-driving cars be allowed to test them on the roads with all of us, right? Are we giving them our data by driving next to their self-driving car, right? So, we're basically part of their experiment, and it's unclear whether we were asked if we wanted to be.
Yeah, because
But,
they those
and
cars have
again,
cameras all around and they are judging the way you drive as well.
and they're using that data to build a product that would presumably make the company money. So I think, as I said, I think this is part of a really interesting, hard, and important set of questions that many people are facing. I shouldn't make it sound like these things aren't being addressed. I happen to be on the side of pushing those questions, also wanting to push those questions forward and making sure that we're addressing them because I do think they're important. And maybe society decides on a set of answers that I don't personally agree with. That's fine. But I would rather have us make those decisions consciously because we had a conversation as a community and as a society at whatever level, country, global. I'm comfortable as long as those are conscious choices, as opposed to choices that crept up because the world changed around us without us noticing.
Because that is what is happening with this story, I think, that we had talked about of the mall in Canada that turned out to be tracking customers without them knowing, and somebody noticed it when the computer rebooted him.
Exactly. There was something, some display, I believe it was actually a mall directory, which tells you where the stores are. And the computer rebooted, and as it rebooted, it listed all the software that it was using, including these tracking software that was using cameras to detect how people were interacting. Now, you walk into a mall, the mall owns all those stores. That's effectively consent, right? You're effectively walking in there and you're saying, I'm in your private property. And stores have cameras that watch you walk around and see what you pick up. And, they keep receipts and they know what you bought. And sometimes you sign up for their programs and you've told them where you live. You give them your credit card data online. So there are many different ways in which we communicate this information in the world. And it may just be that some of this data is incorporated into that larger scheme. But I think that we feel ownership over neuro data, physiological data in a way that really makes that psychologically distinct and that it's reasonable to honor that feeling. As a psychologist, if humans feel like this is important, why shouldn't we honor the feeling that this is important?
This is very fascinating because who has the right to know what I'm looking at? And the second question is, who has the right to know what I'm thinking? So if they may be able to see where I'm looking at, but could they translate that to what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling? And is that data personal? Maybe I don't want anybody to know what I'm thinking about, even if they can see what I'm looking at. And this reminds me of I'm going to take it on a tangent. If you're a fantasy fiction fan, there are these like in Lord of the Rings, for example, there are these creatures like dwarves and elves. And one of the things I remembered about elves is that elves can read minds. So they can read each other's minds. And so they have to be very careful about what they think. So if I am annoyed at you, I cannot think that I'm annoyed at you. I have to structure my thoughts in a way that makes you wonder, hey, something is off, but then is he annoyed at me? So I cannot show myself even in my own private space because somebody can read my mind. And I have this very surreal feeling that that's where we are going because when we are scrolling, we have to be careful about where are my eyes subconsciously going. Is my heart rate going up or down because somebody can sense that? Is my blood temperature going up or not?
And most of us are not yogis. Most of us don't have control over that. So even if I wanted to be very good at managing those signals, I got to tell you, I don't have the kind of training to do that well
Right,
myself.
but you don't have the training because you've never needed it.
True.
And if we reach a point where you need to, say, for example, in a hypothetical country where the government has access to what you're looking at and what you're feeling when you look at something, and say you look at the flag and you are filled with anger, for example, and the government says that now you are not being a patriotic person, it is in your self-interest to now. I'm
These are
just.
fascinating questions. They're a little past what I think is easy to ground, or straightforward, I should say, to ground in the current technologies. But they open up a really important world of future thinking about these issues. And, in the same way that we often draw extreme examples to help us solve a more concrete problem, it seems like this would be a good way to explore some of these issues and take it to the extreme, to see if the logic holds. This
So,
seems like a reasonable solution at this point. Does it hold if
yeah.
we push it a little further out? How about a little further out? What if the government can do this? I think those examples build a lot. I am a science fiction and fantasy fan, so I think that these are the kinds of questions that people have explored and pushed the boundaries of in these domains for a long time. It feels in many points philosophical.
My fear is that not that can neuroscience actually predict if somebody's being patriotic or not. My fear is that somebody might preemptively think that this premature data is enough
To make that
to make
prediction.
that call. Just like how businesses would go for dopamine fasting and the buy button. That is my fear.
It's the lie detector problem, right? That
Correct.
you have this thing that looks like it, we have brain scans. How do we not have better lie detectors? But these scans have all these qualifiers on them and they're complicated. And, I am so enthusiastic for people to use neuroscience techniques to study decision making. And by the way, let's be clear. Plenty of scientists do this without the marketing part. The study of decision making is a very, very old one with a long and beautiful history in neuroscience research firmly. So I think the idea of making it an active part of marketing, of bringing in the economics part, of making it explicitly neuroeconomics is a little more recent. But a lot of the scientific papers that have built the foundation of these theories have been around for a long time. And a lot of what we work on now integrates with the existing structure in neuroscience.
Let's.
Getting back to your point about whether the people might advance, take those pre-bits of science and say that we can do things we really can't do, I think that's a very insightful point. And we have evidence, as you've said, from neuromarketing that we are more than willing to scoop up stuff that maybe isn't 100% for prime time, or we just kind of hand wave a little bit about it because it gets you a result that looks like the thing that you want. And so that's reasonable enough.
Yeah.
There's a flip side of it too, which is really interesting to me. For the companies, how do you define ethical behavior for the companies if we're constantly finding out new things about how humans make decisions? So if I publish a new paper suggesting that recommender systems change the way that we make choices, because I published this paper, is a company now responsible for finding out about it and changing the way that their recommendation systems work because that knowledge now exists in the world?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the complexity around these questions, right? So there's the ethical question raised about how do we make sure that people are being true to what we really know from the science? And then if they're paying attention and being true to what we really know for the science, at what point is that an expectation that they have a responsibility to follow as well?
Change their own behavior.
You know, and science moves forward. And sometimes we're wrong. And that's that, by the way, the wrong part is the scariest part of prematurely using science to make claims about people's lives and existence and whether or not they're patriotic. That makes this much, much more dangerous, because just because two scientists in an academic paper say so, you know,
it's
in
not
10
the
years,
end of the discussion.
We might find out that there was another bit of brain doing something that we didn't understand how to interpret, but with better techniques, we figured out how it all fits together.
Yeah.
And it turned out the way that we were discussing it before wasn't quite right. It wasn't wrong. Right. It just wasn't the whole picture.
Yeah.
So,
and that's just typical of the brain, isn't it? To just have a third feedback loop that you never thought of.
Right, there are all these old adages about, you know, there are some nearsighted old men who come across an obstacle in their path, and they describe it completely differently. One of them says it's rough, and another one says, no, it's rubbery and smooth, and another one says, no, it's very delicate. And it turns out the rough person was tapping the leg of an elephant, and the rubbery smooth person had the end of its trunk, and the delicate person had the fringe of its ear. So it was all an elephant.
Right.
With different interpretations. So the danger is that, you know, all these different techniques might just be showing you different parts of an elephant right now. And once that snaps into focus, the takeaway could be completely different.
Yeah, we might have a completely different view. Let's completely go away from economics, away from market, drop all of that.
Okay.
What is the most exciting thing that you have come across or researched recently about decision making? Something that made you go, oh my God.
Can I talk about something that someone else found? Because it's what motivates a big chunk of what I'm doing. And I have to bring just a tiny bit of economics into it. One of the interesting things about economics, similar to the way that people don't necessarily know that a lot of marketing professors are basically psychologists, there's a big chunk of economics that looks at how people make decisions and looks at their behavior and looks a lot like what we do in psychology. So the field of behavioral economics starts from different assumptions. And I don't like all the assumptions they start off with, but we work together.
Sure.
But they study a lot of the same questions. So when I say I'm going to bring in a little of economics, I'm going to bring in a little behavioral economics. There is this amazing set of papers that are developing and continually being added to from scientists from different labs all over the world. And I'll spoil the punchline right away. What they basically show is that even when we're not making decisions, our brain is constantly attaching value, like decision relevant value, like little price tags to everything we encounter. I'm being a little, you know, a little overly exuberant to get the point across. But I'll give you an example of one of these studies. So this was research where this group of researchers led by Anita Tusha had two different groups of people go into a brain scanner, into an MRI scanner. Group one was shown pictures of cars, and they were asked, how much do you like these cars? And they rated the cars on how much they like them. Group two was shown a vision task where they had to see a little image that was rotating and press a button when it had rotated to a certain point. And that image had a background that was a car. But the group two was never supposed to think about the cars. Group two was never supposed to rape the cars. It's just the background happened to be a car. What they were supposed to be doing was that little moving vision task. So you do a brain scan on everybody in group one, think about the cars, tell me how much you like them. You do a brain scan on all the people in group two, do this little vision task. Oh, incidentally, there are some cars. Don't worry about that.
Sure.
Then you take everybody out of the scanner and you show them all the cars that they happen to see or focused on in the scanner, and you say, how likely would you be to buy each one of these cars? Right? So that's what the participants experienced. What Anita and her colleagues did was that they looked at which brain areas were active in both groups during the task. So your task was to rate the cars or to do the vision thing. And they looked at what brain areas were active in common in both groups, regardless of what the task was. And it turned out that those brain areas coded a signal that was correlated with, that could predict people's likelihood to want to buy the car. Now that makes sense, right? If I'm deciding how much do I like this car, then it makes sense that my brain's doing something that can tell me how likely I'd be to buy it later, right? But if the car is just the background and I'm doing this careful vision task, my brain is still doing something in the background that's coding some information that can tell you how likely I am to buy the car later.
Amazing. Can you tell me which area was this? Do you remember?
They found a network. So off the top of my head, I'm hesitant. I'm confident there was reward circuitry involved, but I want to be a little bit careful about that without the actual names in front of me,
I'm going
particularly
to
given
go.
that we're speaking about being responsible and communicating our science. But I'm confident that there were reward brain areas. And in fact, there are actually, so as I mentioned, there are several papers showing versions of this, that even when we're doing non-decision tasks, our brain can code decision relevant value. In reward-related areas, in prefrontal cortex, in various ways, it's been approached in different ways. There's a really interesting paper that uses a technique that just picks out which brain areas are correlated with that eventual decision. So it's called a classifier model, but basically, it's not looking for, is this brain area correlated? It's saying, like, is there anything repeatable about the way the brain's active that might be used to predict what choices that person can make? And my brain predicts my choices in these situations. So it's not necessarily that someone else's brain can tell you what I'm going to pick, but my brain is coding something. Somewhere in my head, I'm representing this. And I think that's amazing. And it's amazing for two reasons. One, it's amazing. And two, as a decision neuroscientist, as a consumer neuroscientist, as a neuroeconomist, what does that tell me about a grocery store, right? So think about a grocery store for a second, or a bodega, or your local market, or the corner store, or where you go pick up chips in the afternoon, any place where you go buy things. It's an experience that's mostly at this point universal for most people in the world. Everybody's got some version of some kind of market that they visit to get food, if nothing else. There's so much going on in those places. I mean, in the United States, it's incredibly dense with millions of different packages and everything on there, and the size of these stores are it's enormous. But that's true in a lot of markets in different ways, right? There's so much information and it's everywhere, and it's all, not only is it just stuff you might want to buy, but it's screaming at you with bright labels and pretty colors and often really good smells and all kinds of information screaming at you to buy. And even if you're thinking about something completely differently, some part of your brain's like, oh, shiny. Oh, yes. No, absolutely. That one, not that one, but that one. Yes, I agree. Oh, that's great. That seems like a lot of work. How come we aren't exhausted every time we go to the grocery store? Actually, by the way, some people are exhausted. Some people feel this pressure of all those options very acutely. But most of us can just go and get our milk and come home. We can pick up groceries, we can pick up milk, we can get cereal without being so shocked by the density of all the things that our brain is coding at some time. So now, figuring out this decision relevant signal in the lab is going to be way different from figuring it out in a grocery store. I don't really think that our brain is slapping price tags on every single thing that we see all the time, everywhere. But there's some kernel of this happening, right? It's clearly possible, and at some level, something probably is being coded. And so that mismatch between how much information we're capable of managing in these dense, complex decision situations and how much work that is for the brain circuit is a really interesting mismatch. And I think that's one of the most interesting motivations for the research that I do right now.
What I'm hearing from this is that you are never not at a supermarket.
What a great description. I mean, again, I'm exaggerating or making it a little bit oversimplified to get across the point because I think it's so amazing, but yeah, kind of.
Kind of, right? Like every minute of every day, your brain is trying to put everything into some sort of hierarchy system so that it can save time later.
Interesting. You know, that already puts more shape around these findings than I think we have because they're happening in different ways. But there's now, like I said, a handful of academic studies showing that something like this is happening, that it's possible for your brain to code these decision relevant or value relevant signals even when you're not making decisions. And so that really, you know, we talk about unconscious thought and what's going on behind the curtain all the time, but most of the time we figure it's all interpretable. This really sparked for me. This is, I think, one of the most interesting, exciting ideas. And then
It's
figuring out how extensive it is, figuring out, is it really like a grocery store all the time? Or is it just that at this level, it's like a grocery store, but when you actually get to the grocery store, that's so much information. Maybe there's a switch in your brain that flips and is like, nope, stay on target, right? Maybe your brain detects that's enough. This is going to be too hard to do. Let's just focus on the important things. Like, what are the, not just what are the on switches? I think up till now we've been looking for all the on switches, but when are the off switches to make sure that not, you know, because if everything's on, you can't distinguish anything. So what turns it off? What lets us pare down? What lets us focus? What lets us rule things out? Now, neuroscientists have actually looked at versions of these problems in many other domains. And again, you might be more familiar with these findings than I am, but there's an idea in audition and studying how people hear called the cocktail party problem. How
I've
do we
heard.
sit in a cocktail party and focus on what the person next to us is saying when everyone in the room is talking? Right? And the person we're talking to might not even have the loudest voice. It might be that really loud lady in the corner, or the really the guy clearing his throat behind the bar, or wherever, right? So, how do we do this? We are capable of sort of creating this
Bubble.
focus on just one piece of the signal, despite the fact that there's a lot of other people there. And in fact, as we get older, it gets harder to do, and the acoustics in our ear change. And so there's clearly some physical part of our ear that the way it's set up that lets us do this. And again, there is a ton of science around this. But just like the cocktail party and the basics of how we hear things, you know, there's the grocery store party problem in our
This
head.
is I had come across this when I was reading about music and how a trained musician can pick a note and immediately understand that this one note is out of place because of the way that they are trained to give more attention to certain frequencies in a certain sequence. And somebody who's not trained would not be able to do that. Right? And so this reminds me a lot about the gating theory from pain.
Oh, interesting.
So if you it, basically if you're looking at attention, we immediately think of attention from the visual sense, but attention is applicable across all senses. And so the gating theory of pain says that how do you decide if a pinprick is painful or not? So there are some five or six gates from the point of contact to the point of conscious perception that allows you to modulate how much pain is painful, like how much do you let in?
That's amazing.
And it happens at every level, like it happens at the skin level, at the spinal cord level, at the thalamic level, at the amygdala level, at the cortical level. And I found that incredible that we
That is
are.
incredible. And that's amazing. So I mean, from the auditory perspective, you have you know, the ability to manage relative levels of information. And one of the challenging things, you know, some of the information you get is that different distances will give you different vibrations in your ear and change the literal acoustics of the signal that you're getting. And that will then be processed differently. And then you pay attention. And so you right. can focus on those pieces, like hearing the note or like getting this. So there are the physical aspects as well. It's interesting with value because it's not based on the physical presence, right? So one of the cool things about marketing in general is that we made it up. true of economics as well, we made it up.
That's true.
So, you know, like sound is sound. It's there. You know, if a tree falls in the forest, yes, it vibrates the air. It makes a sound. You just didn't hear it. It's fine. and pain, you know, either you got pricked or you didn't. Placebo effects are also fascinating. But at the end of the day, you know, was there a pinpoint or not? That's part of that gate, right? Like it actually has to be something there. Right. Or your nerve sparking in a way that's creating that sensation.
Yeah.
With value is not a primary construct. It is, I should back up a little bit. There are some forms of reward that we call primary reinforcers or primary rewards, right?
Like sugar, survival,
calories, fat, you know, delicious things, primary reinforcers. One of the most interesting early findings in the field of neuroeconomics or consumer neuroscience, kind of all the same plot here. one of the most interesting findings was that the striatum, the nucleus accumbens in the striatum, the same thing that we have been studying for decades and you know, hundreds of years to try and figure out how it responds to primary reinforcers like food. It's the same brain area that responds to things like money or headphones or fancy cars. And that actually was a pretty big finding, right? So there was this assumption that cars and money and all that, that must be in a different brain area because that primary reinforcer is only the biological things, only the biological rewards. And all this extra stuff, we needed all this extra brain layered on top of the striatum and on top of the accumbens to get at all of these more complicated conceptual ideas, like why is a Ferrari intrinsically beautiful or why would it did have value? The fact that the Ferrari takes up the same brain space as sustenance or sugar water or food is an amazing thing because we made it up.
Yeah,
you know, with the lions,
it's a story.
You know, yeah, like the lions on the belt, and you know, the prehistoric societies and things like that. They didn't have Ferraris, so it's very unlikely their brains developed to record what a Ferrari is valued. Yeah. Let alone currency. I mean, currency is an artificial representation of value that you have to understand at a conceptual level.
Right.
The idea that money. I mean, it's not even the same picture in every country. Like the idea that money, can generate the same response in your brain as food or even, you know, chemicals that people use to stimulate their brain, like drugs. That's a big deal.
Power of stories, because we can, in fact, you could argue that we have to be trained since childhood to like a car or like a particular currency, but then Monopoly, the game, would turn that argument upside down, because a $500 Monopoly note is super valuable only during the game. And as soon as it's done, you might find one and you're like, whatever. I just have to put it in the box.
Value is malleable. We can shape it. We can change it. You know, I mean, you know, one ring is super important because it means you're getting married. Another ring is just, you know, a souvenir, another, you know, they can be equal value. An example that I use in my classes, if I showed you a piece of silver jewelry, particularly in the United States, if I showed you a piece of silver jewelry, you might say it was pretty. Yeah, okay, that's fine. And I could ask you how much you'd pay for it. Maybe maybe it's the silver bangle. And you say, I don't know, I paid $50. It's well-made, it's beautiful, it's, you know, whatever, but it's fine. And now if I put that silver bangle into a box that's a particular shade of blue and has the word Tiffany's on it, and I ask you how much you're willing to pay for it, all of a sudden, it's $150, it's $200, same bangle. Right. So this, you know, so that's not surprising in some ways. It's funny to walk through the logic of it, but we kind of know this. We know brands matter, you know. So again, from psychology, all of this is very familiar. Here's to the level of the brain, and you're like, our brains are doing all of this also? That's ridiculous. Our brain thinks the bangle is worth more when it's from Tiffany's than when it's... So my very dear friend and colleague, Hilke Plassmann, has some of the earliest and most amazing work on this. She calls it the price placebo effect. She fed people wine in a magnetic resonance imaging scanner. And that's already amazing, by the way. That's actually a complex technological feat, because it's really challenging to get people to sit very still when they're in these brain scanners, as you know. She had people drink wine in the scanner. And as they were drinking the wine, she showed them the price of the wine. So she fed them a $10 wine and a $90 wine. All they had to do was have this bit of wine in their mouth and roll it around on their tongue, taste it. They got a little sip of a something to clear their palate in between wine tests. Very sophisticated.
Wow.
She currently teaches at INSEAD in Fontainebleau, France. So, you know, she's a good fit with that school. So Hilke has people tasting these wines, and she has them say what they liked better. Now, perhaps not surprisingly, if you ask people, did you like the $90 wine better than the $10 wine? You know, did you like wine? Let's say wine A is $10 and wine B is $90. And you say, which one did you like better? They will often say wine B. And you could say, yeah, they didn't really taste different. They just said that because they know you're supposed to say that the $90 wine is better. So you know, there's some indication that it tasted better, but maybe not. So then she looked at the brain data for the $90 wine and the $10 wine. And in people's brains, there was more activity in orbitofrontal cortex. Not just the value in the reward areas, but actually the taste-related areas showed more activity for the $90 wine than it did for the $10 wine, implying that your brain thought it tasted better. The quick reveal on this is that the $90 wine and the $10 wine were the same wine. She just told people it was $10 or told them it was $90. When she told them it was $90, they said it tasted better, but their brain also recorded it as tasting better. It responded to it as tasting better. It found better taste in the wine when they thought it was $90.
Incredible.
So we're doing this, right? Like, you know, and again, I don't want to be guilty of that problem that we talked about earlier, where if I say brain, like brain data, then that makes it more real. But I do think it's incredible.
It is hilarious.
Some psychology thing that we're finding, it's actually happening at the level of the brain.
Man, I'm seriously wondering how often do neuroscientists go into an existential crisis? Just knowing that none of this is real.
I think what it gives us, what it gives me, let's just speak for myself. What it gives me an insight for, what it offers me is actually a lot of empathy. You know, when people are distressed that their view of the world doesn't fit the way that they know it should be, or they want it to be, or that other people say it is, what these studies tell us is that distress is real. I mean, we still need to make sure that people are capable of behaving in a way that works for us as a society and isn't in their own best interest. And, you know, but these signals are real to them. Yeah. And they're not, they may not be what we want them to be. They may be caused by disorders in some cases, but that doesn't mean that the person is trying to be dishonest or trying to misrepresent themselves. So it does give me some empathy for the fact that even if someone's behaving in a way that's explicitly harmful, if they're expressing distress and this mismatch between what the world is like in their heads versus what the world everybody else is telling them the world is like, at least we can give them the grace of knowing or of acknowledging that their feelings are what they're feeling. I know that sounds a bit trite, but I think that's a really helpful thing to take away from it to prevent an existential crisis.
the closest
is recognizing things are malleable. You know, they do fluctuate. They are different, and I often get asked like whether my own research is ethical. I study how people make decisions. I look at, I mentioned recommender systems. I have published data showing that the things that recommending systems put on the screen can change whether or not you put an item in your cart online when online shopping. So if I'm looking at a particular board game and I see it with other board games, I'm more likely to add it to my cart than if I see a board game with other random items from the store. Companies can use that information.
Well,
consumers can use that information. Companies can use that information too. And so when people ask me, you know, like, how do you feel about the research that you do? I think it's useful for us as people to know how flexible our decisions are. I think it's, you know, it's useful for us to have some sense that these things matter. It's useful for us to check ourselves. Do I really want this?
Yeah.
Hold on a sec. I'm in the middle of the Christmas season. Is it possible? Can I imagine myself out of the Christmas season in the United States and realize that maybe without all the tinsel and the advertisements, I might feel differently about this really cute reindeer statue? Or, you know, or other points of the year, the new year, the fall festivals, things like this, you know, these emotional events might change my decision making.
Why do I feel like the reindeer anecdote is personal and you have one in the house?
I have not bought any cute reindeer statues. I would like you to know. It's very, very austere in here. But I do think there's power and there's value in knowing these things. There's a joke that goes around, particularly consumer psychology circles.
Mm-hmm.
We study a lot of things that people find interesting about their everyday lives, and it's very easy to study what we call me search, not just research. And I do think I'm guilty of that. I have trouble making decisions under uncertainty, and a big chunk of my research studies how people make decisions under uncertainty.
Right.
Because a good decision isn't just one that comes out with a good outcome by other people's standards. My definition for a good decision is one that I am comfortable with.
Mm.
One where even if it ended up badly, I feel like I went through a process that was the best that I could do and held true to what I like and believe and think. And so the more I understand about what things can affect how I make those decisions, hopefully the more satisfied or comfortable or confident I can be in making those choices.
Brilliant.
It's a pretty long quote, but.
So as a neurologist in my clinic, I come across patients of somatoform disorders. People who have, who earlier used to be called as hysterical, and then that term thankfully went out of use. And then it was called as functional disorders, and in the middle, somatiform was the term. So as the understanding keeps changing, the terminology would keep changing. But there are a lot of papers coming out now as to how they're not pretending. It's not really voluntary movement of the arm or voluntary falling down. So just because the MRI is normal and there is no organic lesion, the easy way out is to say that, oh, these guys are just pretending. But the truth is that we don't really understand how decision making works. And so there is a line between conscious and unconscious. So this decision, so to speak, of moving your arm when you're stressed out isn't always voluntary.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of attention being paid on the cingulate cortex and the role that the cingulate cortex plays in between these two, you know, something between the limbic and the cortical. How does a cingulate handle conflict?
Yeah, absolutely. We study this quite a bit in our field as well, actually, even for the more psychological, even for not somatoform decisions, but, you know, cake versus fruit salad.
Right. So it just occurs to me that there is a lot that I want to ask you about that. But I know I also promised you that we will have this conversation for an hour, and I think we've already overshoot it. What I would love to do is to have you on my live stream at some point and introduce you to my YouTube audience and give them an opportunity to interact with you whenever it is possible, maybe next month. And I want to talk specifically about this subconscious decision making. Of focused on this area of when we are in conflict, how do we go forward?
I think it's a really exciting and interesting topic. Sometimes we have access to the conflict, sometimes we don't have access to the conflict, sometimes it changes our confidence levels. I would love to have that conversation. I would be delighted to join you and your audience.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Uma. I can't really express how much fun this conversation was. Thank you so much for joining in.
Oh no, it was absolutely my pleasure. And the questions that you asked are so important and insightful. And I hope that we were able to do them a little bit of justice, because each one of them is the subject for someone's career, if not at least a book. So thank you for raising them and giving us an opportunity to explore them.
Yeah, hopefully, so in India, where I'm from, there is a lot of interest in masters studying and, going abroad and studying neuroscience. So hopefully this conversation will spark interest and have more and more people, thinking about a career like this.
Absolutely. So I was born in the United States. Both my parents were born in India, and their training spanned both educational training in India, but also in other countries across the world. And so I would be delighted to have any part in anyone else's pathway that looked for that, even if it's simply at the level of raising the question.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.